Capital Investment Committee will come to order. First item on the agenda that we're going to take up today is the Metropolitan Council. And they are under clock situation, and so we want to be able to deliver them to where they're going on a timely basis. Chair Zelli, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Murphy and committee members. I'm Charlie Zelli, chair of the Metropolitan Council. It is my great honor to be before you representing the Metropolitan Council. I've got a number of proposals that I think you're familiar with relating to bus rapid transit, parks, and our water system. So I'll go through it pretty quickly. You know, the bus capital improvement plan regarding these two bus rapid transit projects are going to be actually, I think, the future of our transit system. The A line and the C line are performing remarkably well. And if I just look at the A line, which runs, of course, across the Ford Bridge down Snelling Avenue to Rosedale, it has as much as a 33% increase in ridership on that corridor. We think this enhanced service, preemption through traffic lights, thank you, MnDOT, really great facilities, off-board ticketing, has the look and feel of light rail, but has the flexibility of buses, better equipment. So these proposals are for two projects that are ready to go. $55 million for the D line and the B line. I know you've probably had tours. You understand that this is a north-south line and an east-west line. Again, the frequency of this service as we build out this kind of bus system, maybe as many as one a year, we will really have a network of enhanced transit and viability. Moving along to the D line, again, this is from 18 miles from Brooklyn to Brooklyn Center. Route 5 is one of our heaviest traveled corridors, $75 million. This is the $20 million of the $55 million into this project. We would really begin some of this work almost right away and be ready for service in a couple of years. The D line is actually incredibly important for our metropolitan area. These are underserved areas. When I think about 57% people of color, one in four households not even having a vehicle, and access to as many as 200,000 jobs. There's more. We don't like to talk about just one line, but if you were to talk about one line, this is a remarkable result for the level, particularly for the level of investment. Then going to the B line east-west, truly an interconnected system. We all know about 21, which is heavily used corridor, but it is slow. And this enhanced, more express-like service will have two really key stops. One, the West Lake Street, which will connect with the Green Line, and then that mid-I-35 Transit Center, which is under construction now as part of the 35 at 94 project, and then going all the way to downtown St. Paul. So this is a kind of another real backbone facility. And if you look at the funding, it really needs again, this additional investment from this bonding will bring it, march it forward for its service in 2023, about the time the Green Line comes online. Moving along, I'm going to skip rid of our questions.
Oh, look at that. You jumped up here quickly.
I brought my expert IT person here. I should have driven it by himself.
Well, we've been trying to go fast, so.
Sorry. We're moving into the park system. As you know, Metropolitan Council actually manages a lot of the regional funding for the 10 implementing park agencies. You know, you think about the regional use of of many of our local parks, like those in Minneapolis, St. Paul. They get quite a few visitors from around the metro. We kind of think of this as our, almost like the state park system, but it's like the metro park system. And Met Council has a great opportunity to help provide funding. This is a $10 million request, but it really leverages additional funds for a total of nearly $17 million. And we actually have pretty dispersed projects. These are not big one-time only. These are kind of, I would call, bread and butter capital improvements that are really necessary to not only maintain the benefits that we have, but to be prepared for the additional population coming in our area. And it's throughout the entire seven county region. These funds are distributed by a formula. So a formula that's above my pay grade, but it actually relates to population and some of the needs and some of the visits that come from out the region. And it's been totally agreed upon among all the implementing agencies. So I'm just going to touch quickly on our water system. I had the great honor of going through, spending the morning getting a tour of our plant in St. Paul. Pretty remarkable. I mean, this is the 10th biggest system in the United States. And when you think about this, the amount of wastewater that is treated, and if we look at that map, the system, the interstate system, which is in good shape, all coming into St. Paul. And, of course, our other wastewater services covering the rest of the region. Problem is, our system is in good shape, but a lot of the municipal arterial systems are in less good shape. And when you think about the big rain events that we're having, there's fresh, clean water seeping into this system and really gobbling up capacity. I talk to mayors around our region, and they really describe this I&I problem, inflow and infiltration. Very costly to repair, and it's a very clear burden on a lot of our local governments. So this is a great program. This $5 million would be leveraged with matching funds, grants to help really address some of these repairs and eroding pipes that are that need improvement. You know, it's not one of those things that happen at any one time. This is a long-term plan, but if we address it every year, we can be we'll stay ahead of it. We are very fortunate in this region to have a system that is actually in really great shape compared to other regions. But this is one piece, and you know, on the strength of a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and this is the weakest link. This little line here that says local collector system right above our metro interceptor system. That local line is the local collection system. That's the ones that are really having some issues, and we know with this grant program, it really gets very popular with our communities. And you look at all the communities served, there'll be as many as 81 communities will be eligible and would benefit from this grant program. So $5 million is not going to solve it, but it's going to get us well on the way, and I think we'd want to probably kind of nip at this, over the period of every bonding period. So I'm sorry to rush through that quickly. I know this is not new information for you, and we have a few minutes if you have any quick questions, but I'm honored to be able to offer you this, what I think are three really important and great programs.
Has the council requested money for I&I in the past and received?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And Madam Chair, in fact, we have received support from the legislature in the past related to that program. The council receives it. We have a grant program that we work with metro cities on. And what we do is those cities will also apply some matching funds that then gets spread out and distributed to many, many cities throughout the region. We've got some real success stories in Golden Valley. We've got success stories in the West St. Paul. I know Representative Hansen has a number of these issues in his district, but the point of the map is to show that there are many communities throughout the region who have issues with that local you know, municipal connection that needed to get fixed, because we really want to keep that clean water out of our system.
And it's essential that you do. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. And my question is related to INI as well. INI has been something that all cities and the Met Council has to deal with on an ongoing basis. I don't see it being fixed in 1 or 2 years. And I'm curious if there's been discussions or considerations about how this might be incorporated into the charges that local municipalities charge for their utilities, since it's going to be an ongoing almost a maintenance type thing. I'm curious what those conversations have looked like, because I think of the number of individuals that, you know, receive services, and if you were to, you know, go across all those, it's not like raising their rates like $50 a month. It might be raising their rates, you know, 75 cents a month or something. I don't know what the numbers are, but I'm just curious about
that. Well, Madam Chair, Representative, you know, I'm not the expert, and we have a few in the room, but I will think the burden on property taxes and homes, it really varies by community, city by city, and it is a local decision. I don't know, Judd, you want to add anything?
I'll just add that it is a local decision. I know that our folks have those conversations with communities. I don't think that the council necessarily has the ability to force them to do that, but Representative Dean, we'd be happy to follow up with you on that. One of the other points I'd like to make is related to INI. We're talking about bonds that will help us fix the municipal system. There is an entirely other side to this when we talk about the private service laterals that run from your home to those municipal laterals that eventually make it to our regional wastewater interceptors. And we look forward to have a conversation with you about that piece as well. But Representative Dean, we'll follow up with you. We have a staff here in the room who actually manage this program, so we can speak to that with a little bit more clarity for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Zelli, good morning. I just want to dig a little deeper into the bonding request for the Metro Parks and Trails. And so tell us a little more about how many users. I think it's like, is it like 50, 60 million users are kind of out there using? So there's obviously going to be quite a bit of wear and tear. And then maybe just tell us a little more about the matching money and how that works. And then,
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, there is here's the slide: nearly 60 million visitors in 2018. I mean, these are, when you say it's for the region, it's actually for the whole state, or visitors coming. Interestingly enough, we talk about a headquarters economy. The number one attraction that both retains people and brings people to this region is actually our open space parks. And I say that as an arts advocate, because I realize actually it is such an incredible resource that we have. To maintain it, to keep it in good condition, takes ongoing funds. This by no means does it all, but it what I think has been beneficial is, A, the formula that's agreed upon, and two, that these projects, this represents some 27 projects, everything from, you know, rebuilding, worn infrastructure to actually some new programs. This does not address some of the larger issues like a COMO or some other requests that will come in separately as separate requests. This is kind of more of what I call the block and tackling kind of capital program, a more efficient way for us to deploy some of our own funds as well as this funding.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this real quick. When it comes to INI, I think many of us around here understand how well PFA works and operates, and it would be my suggestion that perhaps a combination of a revolving loan fund and grants and establishing a priority list might help us address this problem more effectively. We've been talking about INI for many, many years, and we kind of seem to be making limited progress. A more formal approach might help.
We can look forward to that. Representative Pearson.
Great minds think alike. Representative Torkelson literally stole exactly what I was going to say.
He's like Chad,
I would point out, though, that there are not 59.5 million visitors. It's 59.5 visits, and with a state with a population of 5 million, that's a substantial number of visits, but it certainly would be overwhelming if it was the number of visitors. You'd be doing a really great job to get an import of 55 million people. So, but great job with the park.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, I point well taken. I'm a transit guy, so I count riders, but they're actually rides. So, yes, they're well taken.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Zelli. You receive, or you're asking for $10 million for the park system. And in Legacy, we have a 40-40-20 split for the funding. How much money do you get in Legacy in a year?
Mr. Shetnan.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, I believe we get, I think it's close to $17, $18 million a year. But those are pass-through funds. The council then disperses those out to the implementing agencies. I think that's around the number. I mean, don't quote me on it, but it's in that realm. It's separate from this, yep.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the shout out for West St. Paul before I got here, but I think the issue with I&I is, you know, we look at where population is and the volume of water problems, and we struggle to get 1 million or 2 million or 3 million when we routinely approve 200 million, 150 million to PFA, and we always get forgot with I&I, and it's always a battle. It's not, you can't use this fund or you can't use that fund. This is a 15-year struggle, and I think the last allocation was divided up where only small grants went out, not large grants. So the model of distributing even $1 million out so everybody gets one project versus problem solving doesn't solve problems. So I would encourage, you know, you to visit some of the homeowners who have to pay massive amount of money to solve just one problem. Happy to have you visit West St. Paul and meet some of the people. And they will ask also, do we see an impact with the dollars that we are putting in?
Thank you. Point taken.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
you
very
are
much.
Excused.
Thank you.
Representative Poppy. House file 2959.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
I move that House file 2959 be considered today and referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And Poppy.
House File 2959 borrows $50 million from the bond market to appropriate the proceeds to the Rural Finance Authority, otherwise known as RFA. The RFA is the state's main ag lending arm, and replenishing the funds is a top priority for the ag sector. The program is user-financed. The purpose of the bonds issued is to purchase participation interest in agricultural real estate loans. Each November, funds are transferred to the Department of Management and Budget Debt Service Fund for bond redemption and interest payments on the bonds for the following year. All previous bond authorization money has been paid back to the state with interest. The bonds sold are user-backed general obligation bonds, although they do not require the 3/5 majority vote like you see in the larger capital investment bill. The RFA offers low-interest loan programs to farmers by partnering with local lenders to provide affordable credit to eligible farmers. There are four categories of loan participation in the RFA: basic farm and seller-assisted loans to help younger and beginning farmers purchase ag land, ag improvement loans, which finances farm improvements for any ag-related purpose, Restructure 2 loan helps farmers reorganize farm debt to improve cash flow, and the Livestock Expansion Loan, which creates affordable financing for new state-of-the-art livestock production. The RFA has a strong record of success. Over its lifetime, the RFA has issued nearly 4,000 loans totaling $289.7 million, with only 21 loans coming in for a loss of $555,707 since 1986. And with that, I know that I have friends in the audience. If you needed further testimony or other backup information, they'd be happy to come down. And I do have a letter of support that if you'd also want to distribute.
You got it.
Has that been distributed? Okay, thank you.
Is there a need for more testimony? I don't think we do. The issue was in 2529 that passed out of this committee last spring. So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Poppe, my question's actually on a similar to I had earlier, which is, can we use this model for something else? Can we use, so the Rural Finance Authority has been around for 30, 40 years, and it has provided opportunity for farm businesses, farmers who are businesses. Could we do something, say like an equity finance authority for small businesses that are just getting started out that may not be able to access capital? And there would be a public purpose in that, just like there is a public purpose for helping out farmers. There may be people who just aren't able to get that. Do you think there's a, is this model mature enough where it could be replicated, I guess is my question.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Madam Chair, that's a great question, and I would suspect that that's a possibility. I don't know what the limits would be on that, but it has been a successful program. It certainly, the people behind it know what they're doing to make sure it's very successful, and that is probably the key to the whole operation.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Poppe. Thank you for bringing this forward today. You know, it certainly is an important issue. That's why Representative Hamilton had the motion last week. And we have heard this before. We were aware of it, as Representative Murphy pointed out. And it, I guess, a little disconcerting to me that we wait. And this, it's not just this time. I mean, other years this has happened, too, where we go right up to the brink or past it when the funding has run out. And I would hope somehow in the future that we could find a way to do this in a more timely fashion. I don't know that it's actually going to affect anyone not getting a loan or anything like that, but it just in terms of how we do our business, and again, it's not just this time, it's other times in the past too, that we need to do a better job.
Any further discussion? If not, I'll represent Pearson.
Well, I'll actually pose that statement because that's what I was going to pose the question in the form of a question. Do we know that this is going, because the funds have run out now, according to what we were told, the 21st was when we were running out of funds. And do we know what the impacts then on the offices that are administrating these and the applicants who are trying to receive these loans, do we know what the impacts of that right now are going to be from now until the time that we pass this and get the funds available?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Pearson. And if I need assistance, I think someone will come down to help me, but I'm going to attempt to answer this. And thank you, Representative Erdahl, also for the comments about it's happened in the past, most recently in 2017. And in 2017, the funds ran out the end of December of 2016, and the action was not taken until the middle of February 2017. So about 7 weeks of that drought, kind of, to replenish the funds. This time we're within days of replenishing the funds. So, yes, it's an something that we want to make sure that we pay attention to and that we do replenish the funds. But for those who are seeking funds, they can continue to apply for those funds. And once they can continue that process, and once the funds are replenished, then they are given out, sent out. So if there's any further information or anything that I have misspoken, I would ask Mr. McDevitt or somebody, Ms. Vobel, to come forward.
Ms. Vobel.
Hello, Madam Chair. I'm Andrea Vobel. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you for coming down.
Thank you so much for having us, and thank you to Chair Poppy for carrying this. I will just say that is the reason why we did increase the request from a usual $35 million to $50 million, is to prevent some of this last-minute running out of funds. And I will say we have about $200,000 left, and what we do is we'll send letters to folks contingent upon getting funding to replenish the fund. And so it's pretty quick once we get the funds back in.
So then pragmatically, Madam Chair, at this point, what is the path, or how can we just, I just never have really found any like tension on people not supporting this. What's the path of just moving forward and getting this bill to the House floor? It's being referred to Ways and Means. It has to be heard in Ways and Means, and then it can go directly to the floor. You know, is there anything that the minority caucus can do to help that along at this point?
We could pass it out of here in half a minute. I renew my motion to refer the House File 2959 to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted, and it's on its way to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you so much. Representative Cantrell, the minutes are in our packet, and you want to move the adoption of the minutes as printed?
Yes, Madam Chair.
That's what I thought. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted as printed. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 3309 before the committee.
Representative Vang moves that House File 3309.
So House File, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Samantha Vang. House File 3309 will authorize the state to sell about 21.278 million to correct safety and energy and operational efficiency problems at the MDA and MDH laboratory building in St. Paul. Mechanical and electrical improvements are needed throughout the building to support critical laboratory testing in the areas of emergency response, food safety and infectious diseases, homeland security, and environmental contaminants. And so I have two testifiers with me today who will go on further explain the needs of this laboratory.
And your testifiers were here bright and early, first ones in almost. So welcome to the committee. Yep.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Gary Horvath. I'm the lab director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I have with me my colleague, Joanne, from the Public Health Lab, and we're going to go over the bonding request for the improvements to the lab building.
And the last name?
Oh. I'm Joanne Barkas. I'm the director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health.
Would you spell your last name, please?
B-A-R-T-K-A-S. U.S.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, at the Department of Agriculture, we have responsibility for analyzing samples in regard to foodborne pathogen outbreaks, human and animal exposure to pesticides and other chemicals, food safety surveillance. We do environmental fate testing and a lot of product testing, seed, meat, and the building is a key component of that testing because it's a primary safety device for the analyst performing these tests. Utilities for complex instruments, the ventilation and containment of contaminants and biological agents is important to protect the science and also protect the employees there. And we've been experiencing some issues with the building. And I'll have Joanne talk about her mission here, and she so you get a full flavor of what goes on there.
Thank you, Gary. Again, I'm Joanne Barkas. I'm the director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health. We co-occupy the building with the Department of Agriculture, and we do cross-interact on certain projects, especially as related to foodborne illness, where we get the sort of the human samples and ag gets the food samples. The Department of Health Laboratory also does environmental testing for chemical contaminants, perfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS in water and in people. We do biomonitoring for these chemicals. We would be involved in radiation emergency preparedness in the event of an event at one of the nuclear power plants. We would be involved in testing for chemical terrorism agents. And we do most of what we do in the environmental chemistry section is drinking water and groundwater, recreational water testing and protection. We do newborn screening. We screen almost 70,000 babies annually for 61 different disorders that are treatable if they're detected early. And every year, about 350 or so children benefit from that screening. In the area of infectious disease, I already mentioned we do foodborne illness monitoring. We do some of the core public health testing that you probably are familiar with, tuberculosis, sexually transmitted infections. But we're also involved in emergency preparedness. And we've been doing a lot of that in the past number of years, things like Ebola virus, Zika virus, and most recently, I don't know if you've read in the paper, but there's a virus that's going around the world, the novel coronavirus, and we're actually ramping up now to be able to do testing for that virus in the unfortunate event that it turns up in Minnesota. So as Gary mentioned, we are dependent on this building, our building, to protect our staff and the public. The building is very unique in that it is what we refer to as single pass air. All of the air coming into the building goes back out. Much of it is HEPA filtered. It goes out through hoods, so it's taking out any impurities in the air. The airflow is directional. So to protect people, especially from infectious agents, we want the air going into those laboratories. We don't want it blowing out. So the airflow is directional. So the building has literally hundreds of valves that are controlling the airflow and making sure that it's going in the right direction. The other thing we have are a lot of hoods, including fume hoods. And recently, the Department of Administration managed to come up with a couple of million dollars in CAPRA funds to do some immediate repairs on the worst parts of the building. So one of the things that's happened, and this was a result of probably cost constraints when the building was constructed, galvanized steel was used in some of the ductwork instead of stainless steel. So as we use acids for digesting to test for things like heavy metals in water, we generate a lot of acids, that fumes that go up into the hood, and essentially when that moisture gets up there, it creates acid rain. So this is a chunk of ductwork. This is not a muffler from the side of the road. This is a chunk of the ductwork that was replaced using the CAPRA funds. And I don't know if you can see here, I'm not going to pass it around because it's very sharp edges, but it's all rusted on the inside. So when it comes to protecting our staff, this isn't very helpful. The other thing that's happening in the building is with those air valves. At the time the building was constructed, we put in pneumatic valves, which are fine, they work. Our air flows are the way they're supposed to be, but barely. So one of the items in addition to replacing this ductwork would be to replace the valves with these pneumatic valves with electronic valves, which are more responsive and will work better with the Honeywell system that is kind of the brains of the building, because right now the valves that are kind of the appendages are not talking well with the brain of the building, and that makes it difficult to regulate that airflow. We can do it. The building engineers do a great job of keeping that building running, but we can make it easier for them. I'm going to pass it back to Gary there.
Mr. Horvath.
Madam Chair, I knew when I invited Joanne that she stole my act. So, but anyway, we'll just go through some of these slides just to give you a background on how we arrived at this. So back in 2014,
Thank you for interrupting, but now this is this is renewing and remodeling present.
Yes, we'll talk a little bit about what exactly, but yes, this is for repair and fixing issues that were identified. And as a result of this 2014 event we had, where we had a freezing of the heating coils on the floors, and subsequently when they thawed, we had a flood event, which did a lot of damage to the building. We had rain down on expensive equipment, cubicle space. It was just a disaster. It took the lab down for like 3 days, in some areas much longer than that. So as a consequence of that event, another contributing factor is back when during construction the building was never formally commissioned like you would want to see. We had issues with the price of steel and a lot of budget constraints, and like Joanne alluded to with the corroding galvanized ductwork, originally it called for stainless steel. There were a lot of value engineering things that had to happen because of pressure on the budget. And so because of the flood, Department of Admin undertook a retro commissioning of the building to see what else maybe was out there that was not working. And as a consequence, like Joanne said, the engineers found the corroding ductwork, the valves that control the pressure, which, as Joanne said, is very crucial to containing what it is you're working with and making sure it doesn't get out and get at employees, or in some cases let things get outside into the atmosphere where you don't want them getting, in case of like plant disease that we deal with. So there was a lot of issues, air pressure monitoring. We had trouble controlling certain valves. The system was pneumatic and it weren't responsive, and we had you know, thus leading to the pressure controls. Lighting was inadequate, and there were just some deferred maintenance that had not been kept up with. So,
okay, we're believers.
All right,
we're believers now.
All right, I gotcha. And the other thing is through the course of operating the building, we've had issues with we came to this body a number of years ago and got backup generators, but there still is that gap when the power goes out. So this project also will provide uninterruptible power. So skip over that. So basically, you want to talk? No? Did a good job. So right now, as Joanne showed you, we had the Department of Admin had to spend $2 million in CAPRA funds because some of these issues were so pressing, immediately pressing, that they felt that they just had to get in there. So they used $2 million. They repaired the exhaust controls, which were really an issue. We modified some BSL-3 biosafety level 3 as a level of containment for organisms. And they're in the process right now of trying to balancing the system. And we're still seeing issues of control. And we really do need this project to get all those controllers, both intake and exhaust, on a system and under greater control with the electronic valves. And so we're basically, the contractor is currently on board. Design's underway. We have Knutson on board. We're ready to start this September. And again, we'd ask your support for the $21.3 million for this project. And with that, we'll take questions.
Well, it's not just $21.3 million.
Yes. And then
dollars bonding.
Yeah, bonding.
Also an additional.
Yes. There's an additional general fund request of just over seven. How much? Yeah, $800,000. And what that's for is in the process of doing the repairs. We have a lot of analytical equipment that, you know, is very it's pretty sensitive. We have to bring the vendor in to shut it down to move it, and then we have to have them come in, reinstall it, and calibrate it. We have a number of items like that. So moving expenses, equipment, vendor calibrations, and so there's quite a bit of that in this building. Some of this stuff is really sensitive, and we cannot do that ourselves. So there is that other appropriation of $800,000.
All right. Representative Parkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hate to admit how long I've been around here, but I can remember the old building down on Plato, and we had strips of cellophane or something hanging from the air vents.
Yeah, I started there in 85, so I know that very well.
Because you needed to know which way the wind was blowing, so to speak. And the thought was, when we built this, what I think of as a virtually new building, we were curing those sorts of problems. My question really is, where did we drop the ball?
I'm going to
Ms. Farkas.
Right, Madam Chair. Representative Torkelson, I think we all have been asking that question, and the Department of Administration is here if I muff this answer. But, you know, as Gary mentioned, there were some cost constraints when the building was built, I think that compared to where we were in the Department of Health at 717 Delaware, this building is spectacular. And as I mentioned, it's got a lot of moving parts. So some of the issues that we're seeing are related to, even though it's like only a 15-year-old building, there's a lot of stuff that wears out, and also technology changes. So I think a lot of it was related to the cost constraints of you know, what decisions were made 15 years ago or 20 years ago when they actually started the construction.
Madam Chair, Representative Gary Horvath again. The technology available for the valve control, is my understanding, and sitting in meetings with admin and the vendor, have changed quite significantly in the 15 years. The pneumatic style valve was what was kind of in practice at the time, and these new electrical controlled valves are give a lot more response, and so I think it's just we're victim of technology. And again, I was there when the building was built, and the budget concerns were very difficult to deal with. There were a lot of decisions made that I was, you know, at the time uncomfortable with, but we did not have the money.
Commissioner Wasloski, do you want to add?
Yeah,
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Wayne Wislowski, I'm the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services at the Department of Administration. To Representative Torkelson's question, which is the question we all would ask in this situation, it is a newer building. And when we go back and look through the design narrative, I think one of the questions is this something that the, was it a design error? Was it a contractor error? When I go back through and look at the narrative for the mechanical system, it appears it was built as designed. And so it gets to that point of there were, and it, clearly there was a lot of discussion on galvanized steel versus stainless steel and ductwork. So I think it clearly does seem to be that the budget played a significant role in some of the decisions that were made. And then I'd also just say again, the technology has changed too. There's improved technology, particularly related to valve control, that will work better with our building automation system to control things much better.
Thank you very much. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, we keep talking about the budget. And, you know, being involved in the profession of architecture, I know that sometimes a building gets designed and it's a $100 million building. And the client says, well, we only have $75 million, so make it work. And I'm guessing that, you know, the speed of this project and the things that happen is there was probably what's often called value engineering, which I really hate that term because there's no value in doing that. All you're doing is cutting costs from a project. And when a project gets designed, ultimately that's what it costs. And if you cut money out, people take things out. And this is as much to the state as people on this committee. When we ask projects to do what they need to do for less money, we're setting ourselves up for this. Specific question. Do you know if this the mechanical portion of this project was a design build process, and were they given a budget and they had to try to make it work? And then my next question would be, you know, with Knutson at CM at risk, are we entering into the possibility of a similar type of thing where they have X number of dollars and they need to make it work? Because if they find out that, you know, the cost to them is going to be $24 million to actually make it work, but they have to make it work in, you know, $20 million, they'll find ways to cut out $4 million.
Director Wislowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, it was originally a design bid build, so there was a separate contract with the design firm. So the project got to 100% design and then was bid out on the original construction. So there was a separate design contract, and that team also included a specialty lab consultant. They also did tours of many facilities. So again, I think the knowledge base was there. It really it appears to be there was budget decisions that had to be made.
You know, a quick follow-up. I know the overall project was design bid build, but sometimes within that a mechanical portion might be design build for the actual mechanical contractor to meet that obligation.
Madam Chair, Representative
Director
Dean, thanks for that clarification. That was also part of the original design. So there wasn't design build on the mechanical portion.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
To the other question, Madam Chair, regarding construction management risk, the value of using that delivery method is you bring the contractor on during design process. And so, and we've also, as they've mentioned, we've been working in the facility. We did allocate $2 million of our very limited resource on CAPRA to this project because we felt there was an urgent need there. So we do have a team that is very knowledgeable about the building and the condition. The one concern we have, obviously, this gets bid out after we get the funding, and so there isn't a guaranteed price at this point. And obviously, we all are aware of the pressures that are on both the construction market, both from a labor standpoint and a material standpoint. So we've had the right people at the table during design to help us really vet the cost, and now we'll see how things come out when we bid it. But we should be, and we also have contingency funds available as well. So,
Director, when was this building first opened?
Madam Chair, 2005.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that last point you were making about the constraints that the labor market right now is undergoing, can you articulate like percentages of what we're seeing as these bids are coming in and as they're accelerated with the current labor shortage and the robust economy that we're benefiting from right now? You know, I've heard that anecdotally. I'm in real estate down in the Rochester market, and whether it's commercial or residential, is there a way that you have been tracking that you can give us some sense of how much more we're spending on projects today versus where we were a year or two ago, just from that labor shortage component?
Madam Chair,
Director Representative
Pearson, I don't have specific data, but what I would say is where we see it is particularly is the number of bidders that we have on, whether it's a smaller asset preservation project or even our larger projects. We just are not seeing the number of folks we see. If we get two to three bids, we're happy. And we're still seeing good attendance at our pre-bid meetings, but folks are really being selective about what projects they're bidding on. Particularly, we see this challenge when we're working in our secure facilities where they have to factor in the check-in and check-out through our the security systems, whether it's at our correctional facilities or human services facilities. So if you have to pick between building a new hotel building versus bringing your crews through security systems every day, it's just that they're making those decisions on what is going to be best for their firms. It has varied greatly on how close we are. What we've certainly noticed in the last 3 years is our confidence level and cost estimates is diminished. You just are seeing both sometimes surprised on a good news side and others where it's just dramatically off on estimates. So where that average is on the increase, it's really more of a project by project basis that where we see very significant fluctuations between our cost estimates and where bids are coming in at.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And Representative Vang, thank you very much for bringing this bill. We have heard this before in a couple of different committees, and I think I'm on record rather explicitly expressing some frustration with everything that has happened on this. And really the Department of Administration's, because the question was asked, where was the ball dropped? And ultimately we need to be more accountable on projects like this. Decisions were made, and I posed the question back then, were university campuses pretty much consistently in vented situations like this with the equipment and the type of work that's being done? Were they pretty much universally using stainless steel at that time? And pretty much it's on the record that it was a complete shortcut to use galvanized metal on this project. And it really is frustrating to me. You know, yesterday we took the time to tour a building that's over 100 years old, and I would still argue with almost anyone in this room that except Radine, the architect, with anyone that building will be standing longer than this building that was built in 2002 if we left it alone. From a structural standpoint, from how it was constructed, from the materials that were used, everything across the board, and this really amplifies that we're now spending $22 million fixing a problem from a building that's 15 years old. And I still also I still don't get necessarily answers on who the contractor was. Are we still using this contractor? Because, yes, we can't sue them, but we certainly could restrict their ability to do work on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'm also just going to circle around and highlight that these increased costs of the bids, of the contractors, really runs against the concept of we should be doing this because we can borrow money for less right now. And that's one component, but when you're paying higher labor costs and as you're highlighting with the number of people who are bidding these projects, the number of contractors that are out there that are doing this kind of work, it's a smaller pool, and they do have to make decisions as to whether they're doing private sector jobs or these types of jobs, and whether we have a $1 billion bill, $2 billion bill, $3 billion bill. That will have an impact not just on what the state of Minnesota pays for that work in contractors and in the amount of fees and everything that they're paying with that workforce shortage, but it will also have a negative impact running up the cost for our private sector as well. And we just, as we have these discussions, I just want us to keep that in mind also.
Good point. Representative Vang, we're going to hold House File 3309, lay it over for possible inclusion in the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Director Wasloski, Commissioner Holton, Horvath, and Brackus. Next item on the agenda is the housing, critical infrastructure. Commissioner Holt.
The bar might have been low.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho, and I am the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. I just want to build more homes. That was some complicated, heady stuff there. I just want to walk through the governor's request for investment in housing. And wanted to step back and start with the fact that Minnesota Housing is a somewhat unique state agency. We were created in 1971 as an independent agency. I have a board of directors, which I guess the Met Council is the only other agency that has that. We have independent financial audits. We're rated by the rating agencies. We don't use any state appropriations to pay for our agency operating costs. We're self-funded through the activities that we do in mortgage lending and other things that allow us to be a self-perpetuating agency. The appropriations that you provide are between 7% and 10% of the total program budget that we have, but I'll say that they're probably the most important 7% to 10% of our operating budget. They allow us to really focus on our mission and to provide housing for folks who make the least. The reason that we're here with this request is that housing impacts everything that we do in life, and housing has become an issue in every single corner of the state. We face this conundrum that so many states do right now. The housing supply is low, and the demand is high. And the longer that we remain in this situation, prices will continue to soar. People who could once afford a modest place to live have been edged out by the rising cost of rent. And people who were precariously housed are falling out of the housing market. The gap that people need to overcome in order to get back into housing keeps growing. Prices climb, and the gap grows wider, and the number of people with no place to go continues to rise. We spend more on housing than any other part of our household budget. you know, I think what's really clear is it can't be solely a public sector solution, particularly for low-income households. We have almost doubled our activity since 2011, but it's still not enough. This map shows the percentage of lower-income renter households, people who make $50,000 a year or less, that are cost-burdened, which means that they pay more than 30% of their income on housing by county. And what this makes the point of is that this is actually a statewide issue. It doesn't matter where I travel in the state or who it is that I speak with. People are feeling the impact of the rising cost of housing. And even though the percentages are highest in the metro area, even in the corners of the state, 34% of lower income households have housing costs that are unaffordable. So it varies across the state, but this is truly a statewide issue. Now this graph shows what's happening around rent and what's happening around renter income. And what you see is from 2000 to 2010, rental housing became less affordable relative to people's incomes. There's been a 12% increase in the cost of rent at the same time that there's been a 4% decrease in incomes when adjusted for inflation. So the housing market and the way that these things interact are complicated, but the reality is there are more and more people that just can't afford a place to live. You know, we see this play out in homelessness specifically, where we've had the first significant uptick in the number of people who are homeless, especially single adults and people who are sleeping outside. And we've made progress with veterans, where continual federal investments sure have helped. And we've made progress for families, where we've transformed our programs to get people quickly back into housing. Bless you.
Thank you.
But we're really falling behind with single adults. Statewide, last January in 2019, we counted 8,000 people experiencing homelessness, of whom about 1,700 were people that were not in shelter, people who were sleeping outside. And we have horrible racial disparities in homelessness, where African Americans and American Indians represent 65% of all people experiencing homelessness in a state that has just 16% people of color. I'm humbled when I compare this to what's happening in other states, especially out on the West Coast, but that's why I think that this is still a solvable problem here in Minnesota. So what happened? When the Great Recession happened, when the housing crash happened, we just got behind. We stopped producing. And we now need 300,000 new housing units at all price points between now and 2030. But the vast majority of what's being built right now is built for people who are making more money, market rate housing. So the vast majority of the new construction that you see in the downtowns and all over the state are for people that are making more money. And less than 5% of the new construction is affordable to households who are making below 50% of the area median income. This is the governor's first full winter in office. And when it first got cold in November, the governor and lieutenant governor made a call to action to raise money and create more shelter capacity, which has already brought hundreds of people indoors this winter. They did it because shelter saves lives. The governor and lieutenant governor also want to go big because they know that housing ends homelessness. Housing supports job growth. Housing is about aging in place. That's why they recommended $260 million in bonds for housing, the largest recommendation to date. So I want to talk a little bit about housing infrastructure bonds. First, it's important to understand that nearly all of the housing that we have in Minnesota is privately owned, and general obligation bonds are limited to publicly owned housing. So housing infrastructure bonds were created to provide the gap resources that allow us to build and preserve homes that with households with lower incomes. It's a public-private partnership The housing infrastructure bonds create an incentive for the private markets to develop housing at a lower cost point than they otherwise would. And the state provides the debt service, and Minnesota Housing issues the debt. You know, the uses of the housing infrastructure bonds allows us to preserve federally assisted housing, create permanent supportive housing targeted at people with long histories of homelessness. We have single-family home ownership with housing infrastructure bonds through community land trusts. We are doing senior housing with housing infrastructure bonds. And recently, we've added the ability to do manufactured home community infrastructure as well as acquisition. The governor and lieutenant governor are also proposing a new use of housing infrastructure bonds targeted at renter households at 50% of area median income with priority for the lowest income households. Almost 150,000 renter households earning less than $50,000 a year spend more than half of their income on housing. And there are a large number of cost-burdened households who don't need supportive housing. They don't need supportive services. They just need lower rent. So since 2012, when the state created housing infrastructure bonds, $309 million in housing infrastructure bonds have leveraged an additional $300 million in additional development costs. When we do preservation, every dollar of state funding leverages $4 of federal rental assistance. You know, we typically receive three or four times more proposals than we're able to fund. But in 2019, we were able to do better than that because of the $60 million that the legislature approved in the final minutes of last year's special session. We have a process in place that allows us to get these housing infrastructure bonds selected, tied to projects very quickly, so that when you make your final decisions in May, we're actually able to have selections done in November and developers are able to start construction. The other part of the proposal is $60 million for public housing rehabilitation. Public housing exists in all 87 Minnesota counties. More than 90% of all public housing is 20 years old or older, much older, much of it. Our dollars are really targeted at health and safety and energy efficiency, health and safety features, including fire safety. It's important to understand that two-thirds of the households residing in public housing are seniors or people with disabilities, and about a third are kids. The average income of folks living in public housing is about $16,000 a year. And since 2012, almost 7,000 units of all public housing units have been impacted by our programs. You know, the federal government has largely backed away from its commitment to the structures, to the capital needs of these buildings, and that's why it is that we're requesting funding to step in. If you take a look at the whole public housing infrastructure.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Recently in public safety, we heard Representative Knorr's bill about sprinklers. How many of these, are there a number of places in these public housings that are high rises that do not have sprinklers?
Madam Chair, Representative Considine. Yes, there are, I don't know the exact number, but updating these buildings so that they have sprinkler systems is a part of what these funds can do.
Thank you. I think that's really necessary.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there are about $185 million worth of immediate and critical needs for public housing, including fire safety. We also saw over $225 million of requests for housing infrastructure bonds in the last RFP that we did, so that we know that the need is out there. The need is great. These last two tables just summarize what it is that we've been able to do with housing infrastructure bonds with previous allocations. And what I'd like to do, if there's time, Madam Chair, is just run a quick 2.5-minute video on the impact of the programs. Take me there. fingers crossed.
Everyone wants a home they can afford in a community of their choice because a stable home provides the foundation for success in all aspects of life. But we recognize that many Minnesotans struggle with housing instability, particularly residents of color and members of indigenous communities. In Minnesota, we are so fortunate to have housing infrastructure bonds and general obligation bonds to create and preserve more homes that people can afford. Housing infrastructure bonds are the largest state source of capital for housing development. Bonding allows us to leverage local, federal, and private investment to help meet the state's housing needs. Since 2012, the bonding bill has created or preserved nearly 10,700 homes across the state of Minnesota. To date, $309 million has been leveraged to create nearly $600 million in total development. While we've made great strides, the need for more housing continues to rise. For this reason, we support the Walz Flanagan administration's recommendation that the state commit $260 million in housing infrastructure bonds and general obligation bonds so everyone has a safe, stable place to call home. Seniors, people with disabilities, and families living in public housing are often among the state's most vulnerable residents. Public housing continues to provide the majority of deeply affordable rental homes in our communities, and it is up to us to maintain and preserve those units. Bayview Terrace was awarded $1.2 million in state funding to cover accessibility improvements, including an elevator modernization and a new ventilation system.
I thought the upgrades are well worth it. Billy looks great, and I'm proud of living here.
In addition to preserving the affordable homes we already have, we need to build more. Housing infrastructure bonds help us build more permanent supportive housing like the Park Place Apartments in Bemidji. They help people battling chemical dependency get their lives back by connecting their housing directly to much needed services.
I feel like I'm in a lot better place than I was before. It's like a second chance for me to try to rebuild my life and do well.
At Minnesota Housing, we are committed to ending veteran homelessness. Minnesota is on track to become the fourth state to do so. Minnehaha Commons is a brand new development in Minneapolis financed with housing infrastructure bonds that 11 veterans now call home.
I love Minnehaha Commons. This is a new beginning for me, and I plan on living here for a long time.
Soaring prices on the East and West Coast have precipitated regional housing crises. Minnesota has the ability to address its housing needs before we reach that point. The Walz Flanagan administration's ask for $260 million in housing bonds will help us meet that goal. At Minnesota Housing, we're committed to going big so everyone can go home.
I recognize that you're going to have a lot of hard choices to make in the weeks ahead. The governor and lieutenant governor know that the housing market is not working. And if we don't get this right, it will negatively impact everything else that we're trying to do. We've seen growth in the number of households that are cost burdened, even for people with moderate incomes. And on the severe end, we're seeing continued growth in the number of people that are sleeping outside. We need to signal to the state that we're committed to going big so that everyone can go home. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Could you go back about a third of the way back and repeat what you said was the need for rental, private rental or public rental, or I didn't quite get that.
I don't know if it's the point, Madam Chair, that the private market just doesn't build for people who are making the lowest incomes. The private market builds at the top of the market. If you can sell a home for $600,000 or $1 million, you build a home for $600,000 or $1 million. You don't build a home for $175,000. And I don't know if that was the point.
Well, yes, but then how much were you suggesting that we put into building so that people can rent?
I'm suggesting that we invest $200 million in housing infrastructure bonds and $60 million in the public housing preservation project. And the housing infrastructure bonds are the most flexible dollars that we have. So they do both preservation and new production. They do both multifamily apartment rental as well as single-family homes through community land trusts. So it allows us to meet need. I mean, what it is that different communities need around the state looks different, And it allows us to meet the need that local communities present to us.
So out of the $200 million, then how much are you suggesting goes for rental kind of facilities, new rental facilities?
Sure. What makes our bonding request different, Madam Chair, is that we actually have the money available through a competition. And so it's what it is communities bring to us that defines what percentage ends up going for which type of housing. It's just really responsive to local demand and local need. We don't carve it up in the front of the competition. We wait to see what it is that communities say they want to build.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Just a few points. I mean, there are a lot of critical areas that we face in the state. So we have a lot of tough decisions to make. But certainly housing is a major critical issue. It's not just addressing the need of people to live places, but it's also a huge economic development issue for the state of Minnesota. I'm concerned not just about initial housing, but also workforce housing. And that in greater Minnesota particularly, we certainly have a need. I think, you know, Mr. We have been talking about the situation in Litchfield, which I'm not going to elaborate on too much other than to say we have business expansion coming to Litchfield, and at present we have 21 housing units available for potentially hundreds of people moving in. And it's not just unique to Litchfield, it's across the state. And so I know that there are a lot of bills that have been brought forward this session regarding housing. And I don't know how many are going to pass or what's going to happen, but we need to do something to address this. A couple of questions. I know I've talked to you about this before, but regarding infrastructure, do we have programs for helping private investors with the infrastructure? I'll be more specific. We have a couple of spots in Litchfield where they want to developers want to invest in housing, but they face $500,000 or $200,000 in infrastructure costs that are needed to do those facilities. What programs are available?
Commissioner Ho.
Representative Erdahl, Madam Chair, you know, infrastructure costs are real. Infrastructure costs are real, and somebody needs to bear them, and I think that it is a conversation that local communities are having in terms of who bears the cost. I think the question, if I were in local government, the question is, you know, how much do existing homeowners or existing renters in a community pay for new people to move in? And it's just one of the questions that's out there that local communities need to grapple with. I think now is the time for brave conversations in local city halls around how we incent the creation of more housing. Do you want to jump in, Ryan?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I know Department of Employment.
Baumtrog.
Yes, thank you, Chair Murphy.
Introduce yourself.
Yes, for the committee, I'm Ryan Baumtrog, Assistant Commissioner for Policy at Minnesota Housing, Madam Chair. Representative Erdahl, I know Department of Employment and Economic Development has some infrastructure programs to the extent that they're geared specifically towards housing development. I'm not certain about that. So I do think that with some of the projects we see, we see varying cost differences depending on the level of need of infrastructure that's needed for the housing site. So I think that's a conversation we should continue to have.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding cost of housing in Minnesota, and obviously we have, because of our climate here, we may have some expenses. But do you have any statistics on how we compare with our cost of housing here in Minnesota compared with some of the states around us? Is there anything about our permitting or our regulations that drive up costs here compared to other places?
Representative Erdahl, Madam Chair.
Mayor
Holt. First of all, in my mind, I always separate cost and price because I think there's two different things that are going on right now. If you think, for example, of land prices one of the things that drives the cost of housing is the price of land. One of the things that drives the cost of housing is the price of labor. the price of supplies, regulations, permitting, and many, many other things. There's no single thing. One of the things that drives the price of housing is demand. I think that we are enjoying a place where the economy has been relatively good and where people are moving to the state, driving demand. So the as a homeowner, I am benefiting right now from what's happening in the housing market, but the person who wants to buy the house next to me is not, because the price is going up so much. So I think that it's hard right now to really kind of separate out absolute cost from price and what's happening in the market. But there are certainly many, many, many factors, and not a single factor that's contributing to that. And I think that's important to recognize. I think that we need to have action at all levels of government here. I think the question of what the local zoning and permitting pieces add to the cost is important. I think what we can do with technology in terms of figuring out how to use panelized construction or modular or other ways in which we can build a home. We still build a home the same way that we built a house 50, 60 years ago. There hasn't been kind of the efficiency of productivity that we've seen in other manufacturing areas. We need to kind of just, radically rethink how we do this. But it's many, 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 many pieces that contribute to what's happening to the price of homes right now.
Thank you.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would challenge that assumption that things haven't changed in home construction in the last 50 years, and I think that it's a rhetorical statement to word it that way. And yet, I agree that we need to focus on the things we can control, and some of the things that we're talking about today, I feel like we're kind of going the wrong direction instead of the right direction. And I guess I'll just ask a couple of questions to try to emphasize that a little bit. So again, in the past, we've had housing infrastructure bonds over the last year of about $118 million. Is that correct?
In last year, we had $60 million. That was new authorization. And then with the recent awards that Minnesota Housing did, we awarded about $120 in fall of 19.
So a little bit more than $118. It'd be like $136. So doing a bonding bill at this time, with about $300 million of this type of investment, what type of impacts would you anticipate that having on the labor market and the availability, the current labor shortage that we're facing? Again, can I ask that with the previous testifier as well? Can you extrapolate? Can you kind of anticipate what types of percentages we're going to see in the increases in those bids?
Representative Pearson, Madam Chair, what I know is that we have more households in Minnesota than we have homes. And it doesn't matter where I travel in the state, people are telling me that they need more housing, whether it's because they're trying to add jobs or it's around an aging demographic where people aren't safe in their own homes, that we just have a shortage. And imagine your life without a home. Imagine your life without a home that you can afford. And so I get that we have a labor market shortage and other things like that. But if we don't get housing right, it's going to impact our competitive advantage. It's going to impact how kids do in school. It's going to impact our ability to age in the community of our choice. It impacts everything else. So, yes, there are market forces that are greater than anything that I can control. But what I know is that if we have $200 million in housing infrastructure bonds, we will have more than $200 million of developers who are raising their hand and asking for that money in order to create housing all across the state.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of ask these questions, and sometimes I'm actually looking for the answer to my question. And this is two in a row now of commissioners that really don't bother answering my question. And again, sometimes it's not an easy question to answer, and I get you know, somebody might have to actually come back and follow up with me, and I would appreciate and respect that. But when I ask the question, I'm sincerely wondering what types of impacts that people think that will make on it. So then, again, directing a more direct question, what is our average per unit cost? We've got an anticipated need that's out there that we communicate regularly of the number of units that we need, the number of units that we're short. We just went over that. What is our per unit cost then when you're doing those calculations?
Commissioner
Hall. Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, first of all, sir, I apologize. I am not trying to evade your question. I just, I bring Commissioner Grove in to talk about his understanding of the labor market. What I know is that there's a huge demand for what we do. And so I'm not trying to be evasive, and I hope I don't come across that way. To your question of cost, one thing that's important to understand is that every dollar that we put into a project leverages another dollar and other funding. So there's what is the cost of the project to us as the state, and then what is the total cost of the project. And it varies significantly when we're doing a preservation deal versus when we're doing a new construction deal. So when we do a preservation deal, it's a lower cost per unit than when we're doing a new construction piece. When we're doing larger single family homes, it's a higher price per unit than when we're doing a smaller supportive housing efficiency deal. So if you can take a look at the average cost per unit of our investment, it's actually stayed relatively flat over the course of the last period of time. I'm just looking to Ryan to make sure I get the number right.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Baumtrag.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, I can send up the cost containment report that we send to the legislature every year. We look at every development that we look at goes through a cost reasonableness and a cost analysis about what we would expect it to cost based on what is being done to the project. Historically, and where we're at right now, is just north of $200,000 per unit for total development costs. I would say not all of that is publicly subsidized. As the commissioner mentioned, there's private sector resources in there, so that isn't what the state and Minnesota Housing is putting into the project, but that's the cost to develop the unit.
Madam Chair, I really appreciate that direct answer. That's what I was looking for. You know, again, as a realtor, I know the definition of even a starter home, what people imagine as their starter home. That has changed in my 12 years of being in real estate now. You know, it used to be like just an old house in an old neighborhood, something established with maybe a one-car garage or no garage at all. And now a starter home, everyone expects they're going to have a three-car garage and maybe an unfinished basement, right? And so we really have adjusted some of that line of thinking. I do also just want to emphasize or mention that I think some of the policy choices that we make here in the legislature do have an impact on the access to affordable housing. Simple things like, and these are good public policy choices, I believe, letting people age in their homes. Well, that creates that availability of that home not being available for someone else. So while it's reduced the burden on our health and human services budget, it's amplifying our issues that we're dealing with here. The only other thing, I guess, in just kind of going over everything that you were talking about, this chart specifically, the one that's, again, the need to go big, referencing the median monthly rent versus the median renter annual income, I guess I'd love someone to just cross-check the math, because actually this is showing an improved position if you're extrapolating the numbers, because the rents have only gone up since 2010, rents have only gone up by about 10%, but the annual median income has gone up by 18%. So that actually would show an improved position. And I recognize not all Minnesotans are benefiting from that, and that there's folks that fall outside of the median. And so I guess I would actually point out your chart as showing an improved position for the state of Minnesota, and just reviewing those numbers to make sure that we're accurately portraying the real need that is out there. Because I don't actually think the chart, I mean, graphically it looks like we've got a problem, but the numbers, when you line those up, I think are actually showing a much improved position since 2010.
Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, My parents have lived in the same home since 1965, and when they bought it, they didn't buy a starter home, they bought a home. And it's just striking to me that even our language of how we think about home buying implies something different than what it is that we used to expect. And, I mean, what I know is that people are paying more than they can afford. And if this graph doesn't do a good job of depicting that, we can look for other ways to do it. But people are paying more than they can afford, and folks are priced out. And I just came back from a national conference on homelessness out in Oakland, California, where they have 3,200 people sleeping outside in one city. We have 1,700 people throughout the state that are sleeping outside. But what happens is that when the housing market is broken, people who are precariously housed fall out. They fall out into homelessness. And we've seen this happen in large West Coast cities at a rapid, rapid pace. And, you know, we're at a point here in Minnesota where people are being priced out. And we have an opportunity to act. And, you know, I think it's a cautionary tale of what's happened on the West Coast, that if we don't act now, we will find ourselves in the years ahead wondering why we didn't act now and considering things that would be inconceivable for us to consider today in order to get caught back up. So,
thank you. Representative Cantrell, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for all your work to ensure that no Minnesotan has to go without safe and stable shelter. You mentioned a little bit about the estimate of Minnesotans who are sleeping outside. Do you have a rough estimate of the number of Minnesotans who are either just housing unstable in general or Minnesotans who are cost burdened by the current rental market?
Representative, Madam Chair, in January of 2019, we just did another point in time count at the end of January. We don't have the results of that yet. I fear that the numbers are going to be higher. But when we did the homeless point in time count last year, it was 8,000 Minnesotans that were either in emergency shelter, transitional housing, or sleeping outside. And that was an increase from the previous year. The biggest spike was in the number of single adults and the number of people that are sleeping outside. And that should really give us pause. Our shelters are operating at capacity. In terms of the number of households that are cost burdened, I'd go back to the that there are 200,000 owner-occupied housing that are cost burdened, which means that people are paying more than 30% of their income on their mortgage, and 250,000 renters who are cost burdened, paying more than 30% of their income on rent. I 30% has been the standard of how we think about that for a long time. When people are cost burdened, you know, they're making trades on everything else that they need in life, and that's a real challenge. Thank you for that question.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We have questions or comments still to make on this panel, but we will not have them today.
Be happy to join you at any other time. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present.
Thank you for presenting the issue before us in our and we will keep what you said to contemplate over the next few weeks.
Thank you.
Members, we will return here at 8 o'clock on Thursday morning. This meeting is adjourned. Commissioner.